can do it. The other ones that go self-defeat themselves. It's awful. It's awful. And Trump's just going to pick up the pieces if we don't get Mike in there.
Michael Bloomberg's presidential campaign takes flight, at least for some. It's Friday, February 14. Happy Valentine's Day. This is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, the spread of COVID-19, worse than we thought. Did President Trump meddle with U.S. justice? And helping science by donating a part of your brain? It's all on today's VOA Asia. A shocking development. The total number of deaths at the epicenter of the coronavirus in China's Hubei province rose by over 1,300 on Thursday. Dr. Michael Ryan, executive director at the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program, explains.
In the last 24 hours, China has reported 1,820 laboratory-confirmed cases, bringing the total cases to 46,550. In addition, China reported 13,332 clinically confirmed cases in Hubei province. And crucially, we understand that most of these cases relate to a period going back over days and weeks and are retrospectively reported as cases since sometimes back to the beginning of the outbreak itself. So this increase that you've all seen in the last 24 hours is largely in part down to a change in how cases are being diagnosed and reported. So in other words, in Hubei province only, a trained medical professional can now classify a suspect case of COVID-19 as a clinically confirmed case on the basis of chest imaging rather than having to have a laboratory confirmation. This allows clinicians to move and report cases more quickly, not having to wait for lab confirmation, ensuring that people get to clinical care more quickly, and also allows public health responses in terms of contact tracing and other important public health measures to be initiated. There, as you've noticed with suspect cases, there have been some backlogs in testing, and this is also going to help in ensuring that people get adequate care and that adequate public health measures can be taken. So we're not dealing from what we understand with a spike in cases of 14,000 on one day. To an extent, this is an artifact of the reporting, and we are working with our colleagues in China. Our team there are working very hard to see exactly how many days and weeks and how those numbers are spread out across those days and weeks. In the rest of China and the rest of the world, laboratory confirmation for reporting is still required. And WHO will continue to track both laboratory and clinically confirmed cases in Hubei province.
Dr. Michael Ryan with the World Health Organization. Now, in addition, Japan's health ministry announced that a woman infected with the new virus has died, becoming that country's the first confirmed fatality. Health officials also said that they will allow some elderly passengers on the quarantine cruise liner Diamond Princess, who test negative for the COVID-19 virus, to disembark ahead of schedule. That comes as another 44 new cases were confirmed aboard the vessel. This brings the total number of cases on board to 218, plus one quarantine officer. Now, some have raised concerns about the conditions on the ship, where about 3,500 people remain. As it turns out, European Union health ministers agreed Thursday to boost preparations and coordinate their response to the COVID-19 virus. At an emergency meeting in Brussels, officials from the 27 EU nations said they need to plan to avoid any possible shortages of medicine or protective equipment during the outbreak. Journalist Nicolas Pinon is in Paris and monitored the meeting. He spoke with our colleague Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago.
Well, this meeting was to make sure that health ministers and their governments in Europe are sufficiently prepared and respond efficiently to the current crisis, and especially the European Commissioner for Health and Food Safety, Mrs. Stella Kyriakides, took the stand to talk about the situation in Europe, and they wanted to make sure that all the states faces, you know, with the same ability to respond to the virus, to respond to the fear in their public opinions. And right now, there was this general meeting and nothing really concrete, nothing really big was announced during this meeting.
So are they looking at any steps in particular for governments to take?
Yes. So the three key points in this meeting that was agreed among the EU Council is that they're going to enhance cooperation, they're going to enhance sharing information, and vaccine development. That's the three points that they really focus on. And there was something also interesting is that we heard from states such as Greece, for example, or Czech Republic, who wanted to reinstall the Schengen area and make sure that we could control citizens and travelers within the Schengen area. And so far, it has not been approved because, according to the EU Commission, everything so far based on scientific proof, there's nothing that suggests that enforcing border controls within the Schengen area will prevent the spread of the virus, which also has been very limited within the Schengen space and more globally within the European Union space.
What is the situation as far as the virus is going in Europe? Is there a growing fear that the virus is going to latch on to the population there?
If you take, for example, France, where I am right now, we only had 11 cases, and so far all of them are doing good. And on Wednesday, two patients were able to leave a hospital in Paris, and one is supposed to leave a hospital in Bordeaux this Thursday. So all patients, for example, in France are doing pretty well, and you don't have that general fear because, as they said during the meeting today, the health minister's meeting, EU states are well prepared. They have a health system is pretty efficient all across the states members. So you don't have that general fear, even if you had cases, for example, also in the UK and Germany also. So so far, you don't have that big fear that the virus would spread all across the EU member states.
Nicolas Pinon speaking in Paris, talking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Tokyo Olympic organizers say that the 2020 Games will not be waylaid by the virus spreading from neighboring China. A cruise ship turned away by other Asian governments because of virus fears anchored Thursday off Cambodia, which is checking the health of its 2,200 passengers. And a powerful earthquake hit Japan's northern coast Thursday, but there were no reports of serious damage or injuries and no danger of tsunami. You are listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Splintered results for the Democratic presidential contenders from their first two state nominating contests have further muddled the race and divided the moderate wing of the party. With no clear frontrunner, some are seeing an opening for former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg's media-driven campaign for the nomination. VOA's Brian Padden reports on the billionaire businessman's unconventional strategy of foregoing early contests as he attempts to overtake a field of candidates that some Democrats view as too flawed to defeat President Donald Trump in November.
The Michael Bloomberg campaign bus arrived in Richmond, Virginia recently, drawing a group of ardent supporters who believe the billionaire businessman and former New York mayor is the only Democratic candidate who can defeat President Donald Trump in the November presidential election.
He can do it. The other ones that go self-defeat themselves. It's awful. It's awful. And Trump just will pick up the pieces if we don't get Mike in there.
Bloomberg sat out the early state contest for picking the Democratic nominee. In those elections, progressive Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has been the overall top vote getter. But his agenda to make college education and health care free is seen by many moderates as polarizing and extreme.
But I don't think he can build a coalition, and I don't think he can beat Trump. And we need somebody who can win, and moderate has to be it.
Thank you, New Hampshire!
Moderate contenders, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar have performed well but may struggle as the contest moves to states with more minority voters. Meanwhile, former Vice President Joe Biden has stumbled badly in the first two contests. As a late entry into this divided race, Bloomberg, who was once a Republican, is billing himself as a unifying force.
I'm running to bring our country back together and start putting the United back in the United States of America.
The former mayor has won the endorsement of party leaders like Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. He also has donated millions of dollars to Democratic candidates and to organizations fighting climate change and gun violence. Supporter Calandrian Simpson Kemp lost her son to gun violence.
Ain't no one cares about our tears, but I can tell you somebody that does. That name is...
But Bloomberg has been criticized for his stop-and-frisk law enforcement policies while mayor that targeted minorities, though he did apologize late last year.
I now see that we could and should have acted sooner and acted faster to cut the stops. I wish we had. I'm sorry that we didn't.
Bloomberg's self-funding of his extensive national campaign also has drawn criticism from Sanders and others that he is attempting to buy the election. All this will be put to the test when Bloomberg is on the ballot on Super Tuesday in March, when 14 states with large diverse electorates go to the polls. Ryan Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Happening now in Asia, a bevy of new laws across Southeast Asia barring dissemination of fake news are being put to the test by the spreading coronavirus, with bloggers in at least two countries facing possible prison time for postings as short as one sentence. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The U.S. Justice Department's decision to back off its sentencing recommendation of 7 to 9 years for Republican operative Roger Stone and subsequent resignation of all four federal prosecutors of the case sent a jolt through Washington this week. Republicans largely are brushing aside calls to investigate possible political interference at the Justice Department after the agency asked for a lighter prison term for Stone, President Trump's longtime friend and advisor. Democrats requested Barr address the matter. The Attorney General has agreed to testify before Congress on March 31st. Robert Dietz, professor of policy and government affairs at George Mason University, had this reaction to the decision.
Cases, depending on the sort of the intersection of law and politics, can often become fraught. And that's certainly true in this case. The president has shown great sympathy for Roger Stone, and I'm sure Roger Stone has directly or indirectly encouraged the president to sort of do something. and the president has done something, denouncing the sentencing recommendation, and the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, has responded to that by saying that the sentencing recommendation by the career prosecutors was too strong. And, of course, the Attorney General, as senior Department of Justice official, has that authority to do so. It is fraught because, no doubt, the Attorney General is going to take some flack for it. But I doubtful that this is going to actually help Mr. Stone, because the federal judge in charge of this, Amy Berman, is known as having enormous integrity. She reads the newspaper. She knows what's going on. And I suspect that lesser sentencing recommendation that DOJ is putting forth is going to have much of an influence on her. You know, look, I could well be wrong, but I don't think this is necessarily a favor for Mr. Stone.
What about the president interjecting himself into all these cases with his tweets and his opinions, and they're a sham, and congratulating the Attorney General? You talk about separation of powers with the judicial system. What about the Justice Department?
Well, the Justice Department is not an independent branch. It's part of the executive branch, and the Attorney General works at the pleasure of the president. Now, by tradition, there's tended to be kind of a wall between the White House and the Department of Justice. That wall seems to have gotten incredibly flimsy with Attorney General Barr. But, you know, if you look historically, presidents have had influence on the Department of Justice. And certainly in choosing an attorney general, a president has a right to say, okay, this is the kind of attorney general I want. And, you know, again, I think it's a mistake for the White House to have that kind of influence on DOJ. But it's not by any means unprecedented. And this is partly the responsibility of the oversight bodies in Congress, the Senate, the House, to make sure that the Department of Justice is not overly politicized.
Wouldn't it seem like it could potentially be if these if the Attorney General overrules career prosecutors who worked on the case to just reduce the sentence of a friend of the president, and the president not shying away from tweeting about his displeasure with the sentence?
The appearance is awful, and it does not, I don't think it does credit either to Mr. Barr or to Mr. Trump, but it is certainly not unprecedented. And again, the DOJ is within the executive branch. I think smart presidents and smart attorneys general maintain that kind of wall between the White House and prosecution, but nonetheless, that potential is in there because the Attorney General works for the president.
Robert Dietz, professor of policy and governmental affairs at George Mason University. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London. This news break from VOA Asia, Human Rights Watch is urging that the Afghan government to take immediate steps to provide justice, support victims, and protect witnesses in sexual assault cases implicating powerful people. You can learn more on this story and others at YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's a neurological disorder typically associated with seizures. Epilepsy affects millions in the United States alone. Now patients are helping scientists find new treatments by donating living brain tissue for research. VOA's Arash Arabisadi takes us into the operating room.
In January, Jeanette Hoffman donated to science by letting surgeons open her skull.
So in order to do these surgeries, that part of the brain is going to be removed regardless, and that offers us the chance to use that brain to advance science.
Hoffman suffers from epilepsy, and seizures have been a part of her life for 30 years. Surgeons removed a seizure-causing piece of her brain the size of a lima bean and sent the invaluable tissue to researchers.
If the cells were not viable, for example, in post-mortem tissue after a person passes away, you wouldn't be able to measure dynamic properties of cells, for example, the electrical activity.
So medical staff pack the brain tissue in ice, load it in an ambulance, and take it to a research lab. Scientists say this is a gift that makes their research possible.
We can't do any of this work if we don't have a steady supply of research specimens coming from the local hospital. And so certainly that's something that we always like to recognize, is the generosity of the patients who donate their brain to science.
researchers use an artificial cerebral spinal fluid to cool and preserve the health of incoming tissue transported as quickly as possible. With the brain tissue safely at the lab, scientists process the specimen into brain slices much thinner than a small coin.
Ultimately, as we build our way up, we can eventually try to understand the way that these cell types and circuits process information and perform these computations that allow us to perceive and also control action.
Now back to Jeanette Hoffman, a proud patient making possible this kind of research.
The whole idea of helping someone live a better life, I never thought that I could be that effective. You know, I'm not a doctor or a scientist. So it gives me honor to know that I may help someone's daughter or son or relative to have a better life.
Most epileptics don't need surgery, but all epileptics may one day have volunteers like Hoffman to thank for advanced treatments to their brain disorders. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Finally, once considered a lover's holiday, St. Valentine's Day has extended into a celebration where people express love for family members, friends, colleagues, and community members, as well as spouses, lovers, and partners. Sales of flowers and chocolates peak around mid-February. I can attest to that. And restaurant business thrives. VOA's Zlatica Hoch has this report.
Valentine's Day has long been considered a day for young people to focus on romance and express loving feelings with flowers, greeting cards, and chocolates. But you can fall in love at any age, as this Florida couple attests. Jackie and Lee Adelson met online 8 years ago after their longtime spouses died and fell in love during their first meeting.
Oh, I proposed very early. As a matter of fact, the first time I met her family, it was at her daughter's house, and the daughter started talking to me. I said, "Lori, I'm in love with your mother." And she looked at me like I was some kind of a fruitcake. She says, "You just met her." I said, "I know I just met her, but I'm in love with her."
Greeting cards are sent to beloved family members, respected colleagues, and all others who deserve to know they are loved. William White is a 104-year-old U.S. Marine veteran who earned a Purple Heart in World War II.
I have received approximately 40,000 cards, and I cannot pick out any one to say that this is the number one. My number one is all 40,000 of them.
The cards to Major Bill, who lives in a retirement home in Stockton, California, began pouring in after a fellow resident launched a social media campaign called Operation Valentine, calling for people to honor the veteran. The goal was to get about 100 cards. Roses are the top Valentine merchandise, and most of them are shipped to the United States from Colombia. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection inspected over 7 million stems of roses last year ahead of St. Valentine's Day.
That is correct. We measure flower shipments by the stem and not by the box. So as we look through all of these things, we're shaking them very gingerly so that the petals and everything are beautiful and that the bouquets, when they arrive to your office or to your loved one, that they arrive looking beautiful as ever.
Restaurant business and entertainment industry also thrive during the Valentine's Day week. Each year, a new crop of romance movies get released on Valentine's Day. The offerings this year include The Photograph and Downhill, which is an American remake of the 2014 Swedish comedy Force Majeure. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
And that is VOA Asia for today and for this week. We hope you have a very happy St. Valentine's Day and a very good weekend as well. We'll see you again back on Monday. I hope you'll be with us. Until then, be well.